Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Sound Civilization panel in the frame of Cosmic Awakening. My name is Natasha Kelly, and I'm really happy to be allowed to do the moderation of this afternoon event on a Sunday. Nice to see all of you here. Just a quick rundown of the program. We will, first of all, be listening to a talk from Louis Chudesoke. After that, there will be a direct Q&A, so get your questions ready and prepared. After that, we will then be listening to a second keynote by Anne Cotton. And after that, enjoying a performance lecture by Dudizule Matonsi. These two will then reappear on the stage alongside Loni Holly for a talk on the panel, which I am allowed to moderate. Yeah? We will try and keep in track of time, because after that, there is a concert happening in this space. Not that we want to throw you out, but we will be asking you to take a nice break and come back to the concert afterwards. Okay? So, it's my honor to actually introduce you to Louis Chudesoke. He holds the George and Joyce Wine Chair in African American Studies and is a professor of English and the director of the African American Studies program at Boston University. He is editor-in-chief of The Black Scholar and founder of the Sonic Art and Archiving Project Echolocution. We'll find out what that means later. Chudesoke's work focuses on race, immigration, and cultural conflicts and exchanges. He has collaborated with numerous artists, performers, and programmers on projects focused on sound, music, race, and technology. With iconic Berlin electronic artist Mouse on Mars, he has produced sound installations in the album Anarchic Artificial Intelligence and was curator of Carnegie Hall's 2020 Afrofuturism Festival and is author of The Sound of Culture, Diaspora on Black Techno-Poetics, and acclaimed memoir Floating in a Most Peculiar Way. Round of applause for our first speaker, Louis Chudesoke.
Thank you, Natasha. Can you hear me? Don't worry, echolocution is supposed to be hard to say. On purpose. Thanks for your time and attention, and thanks to Hakave for inviting me back and for allowing me to do a kind of experiment. What I'm going to do today is read a portion of a lecture that was written 100 years from today. It was written 100 years from today, and it reflects on revolutions occurring around us right now in 2022. So it's kind of a science fiction, nonfiction essay. Now, the revolutions that it reflects on relate to so-called NBIC technologies, nanotechnology, biotechnology, information technology, and cognitive science. Now, this is really important. For those of you who are not familiar with the specific technologies that I'll be talking about, brain-computer interfaces, BCIs or BCMIs, brain-computer music interfaces, it's really important that you understand that I'm not making this stuff up. These are actual technologies that are available to us now. In fact, the reason it's important to talk about them in this context is they were proven medically safe just this year and were given FDA approval in the United States, and they will be fully commercialized within 5 years. Again, the tech that I'm talking about today is real, but what I'm doing is imagining what happens to that tech culturally over the next 100 years. Cool? All right. November 12th, 2122. At the start of the 21st century, much of the anxiety around artificial intelligence was concentrated on machine replacement in the labor force, algorithmic colonization and bias, and the emergence of technology empires. These empires became even more threatening to traditional systems of governance and social organization than the autocracies they initially produced. 100 years later, we realized those anxieties were symptoms of a singular fear. This fear had haunted Western culture from the slave trade, colonization, and industrialization. It was a fear of becoming slaves themselves, or at least second-class citizens to their machines. It was a fear of accommodating another species on a crowded and precarious planet, a species more powerful and requiring more resources than the fragile planet could afford. Those anxieties, shaped as much by race as by technology, were likely what prevented the West from acknowledging the true reshaping of the world happening in a more intimate set of interactions between biotechnology and information technology. The merging of these two would render the opposition between human and machine meaningless. Experiments in body-machine interfacing took place throughout the 20th century, from the invention of electroencephalography, EEG, by German psychiatrist Hans Berger in 1929. EEG represented brain activity visually, but sound became more prominent after it was discovered that brain signals generated distinct rhythms. In the wake of cybernetics in the 1950s and 60s, EEG allowed scientists and artists to explore the border between machine and human systems. But it wouldn't be until 2022 that the most significant breakthroughs would occur. By the end of the 20th century, the clinical use of BCIs on animals had yielded remarkable results. Test subjects were able to do everything from controlling robotic limbs to playing computer games by brain signals alone. And bionics and surgeries replacing human organs with artificial ones had become so commonplace that few thought of these procedures as threatening in terms of the encroachment of machines into human bodies. Things would change when the organ under consideration was the brain. In July of 2021, the American Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, authorized full human trials of what had first been called BCIs, brain-computer interfaces, in 1973 by computer scientist Jacques J. Vidal. Though various industries took a collective gasp, most Westerners ignored it, feeling perhaps overwhelmed by how routinely the lines between science fiction and social reality were blurred in the 21st century. They were more likely distracted by the great disruptions at work as technology and media empires began to instigate shifts towards political autocracy. FDA authorization was first granted to the company Synchron, founded with funding from the Australian government and the United States Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. This was, of course, when the United States was still capable of funding high-level advanced research without church oversight. Synchron's primary competitor was Neuralink, a company co-founded by tech industrialist Elon Musk. Musk, as we now know, would eventually make the link between infotech and biotech complete in 2030 via merging Neuralink with another company he co-founded, the Mars-based artificial intelligence research laboratory, OpenAI. What Synchron had on its side was a unique invention, the Stentrode. Though a clumsy step towards today's submolecular interfaces, this invention was as significant in 2122 as microphones or sound recording were in 1922, even as important as the first permanent artificial heart implantation in 1982, or the founding of Kurzweil Music Systems and its primitive sampling keyboard that very same year by African-American musical icon Stevie Wonder in partnership with Ray Kurzweil, former director of engineering for the also Mars-based company formerly known as Google. For those who have forgotten, the outmigration of large tech companies to extraterrestrial locations in the late 21st century was as much to do with tax avoidance and populist hostility as to the harsh restrictions on biotech in the United States once it ceased being a secular nation. We recall Kurzweil as a prophet for his tireless advocacy for machine spiritualism and what was called in the 21st century the singularity. That term was feared as the moment when technology and artificial intelligence would outpace human capacities. This was deeply misguided. As Kurzweil taught us, the singularity was instead when human mind and AI blended in ways that redefined human and machine as complementary and mutually dependent. BCIs, especially those that flooded the market in the wake of the success of the Stentrode, was when and how this began to occur. Now that BCIs are implanted in utero, it's important to remember why they were created in the first place. In less than 100 years, they would lead to our world of 2122, where we depend on them for everything, from material needs to entertainment to our fundamental understanding of and interaction with reality. It might be strange to remember that BCIs were initially developed for medical purposes. They were for individuals with limited motor or communication capabilities, paraplegics or quadriplegics, for example, or those who suffered from amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, and had lost control of voluntary muscle movement. Neurological data could be decoded and translated into voluntary actions by way of external hardware, say robot prosthetics, or on screens, say cursors or virtual keyboards. Previous attempts to decode electrical signals from the brain required external electrode sensors, for example, through headsets, or required external wires connecting the head to a computer. The Stentrode was implanted into the motor cortex of the brain via a minimally invasive procedure that entered through the jugular vein. By the way, again, I'm not making that up. That's a real thing. That it was wireless was a significant development from earlier methods, such as scalp electrodes, which featured muddy or distorted signals and noise that led to imprecise decoding of neural activity. Even when wearables were upgraded, they could not compete with BCIs. The Stentrode operated by way of standard Wi-Fi, as was Neuralink's interface. This led to it being marketed as Bluetooth for the brain. Again, that is real. Elon Musk's Neuralink interface required invasive surgery and an industrial robot to do that surgery, since human beings were not capable of such precision. The surgical robot was far from ready for FDA approval, given that it operated via AI. AI was at the time, the early 21st century, subjected to restrictions reflective of the cultural bias against it. There were also legal complications that arose with insurance companies and liabilities in the context of medical malpractice. These restrictions remained, even though the company formerly known as Google had already in 2016 successfully pressed the American National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, to recognize autonomous vehicles and self-driving systems as responsible for their own choices on the road, which was revolutionary because it was a right previously held only by humans. True story. Though an achievement in the struggle for legal personhood for machines and civil rights for algorithms, it proved impossible to translate into general legal precedent. Historians argue that this was due largely to the prejudices against machines that began to surge as the United States abandoned secularism. In both cases, Synchron and Neuralink, the procedure took less than an hour in a doctor's office and did not require hospitalization. after the commercialization of BCIs, the process became increasingly affordable, so much so that unlike most new technologies, BCIs were never an elite luxury. They spread faster than the great obsession of the 20th and 21st century, the smartphone. BCIs became so cheap so quickly that by the end of the 21st century, people began to speak of them not only as a human right, but as upgrades necessary for shared access, equality, and social justice. But by 2050, Neuralink's interface would become just as impactful as Synchron's because it allowed higher bandwidth. That significant increase in information traffic enabled something the Stentrode could not initially do, two-way interaction between the brain and computers. This symbiosis was a professed desire of Elon Musk and Ray Kurzweil, the latter being a transhumanist and the former a relentless opportunist for whom the brain was ripe for branding. Two-way data sharing and translating of signals between brain and computers never achieved the scale dreamed of by Musk and the transhumanists. For one thing, it proved physically impossible to upload the complete human brain, but they tried. Yet BCIs still reshaped private human consciousness as well as the public world of power, commerce, and difference. They rendered those two realms, after centuries of tension, indistinguishable, as they always really were. The technology was quickly employed for virtual or augmented reality systems. This ranged from military applications, which had of course begun much earlier, to gaming, entertainment, and mundane but necessary activities, such as texting, email, shopping, and banking. Because AI was now intimate with the brain and had sufficiently mined users for habits and responses, it became less an external presence than an amplification of intuition, the voice of the soul. There would also be a revolution in human socializing and sexuality as third and fourth generation users reevaluated their relationships to their bodies and to each other. Some historians and critics argue that these changes allowed people to remain indifferent to the structural transformations that occurred as the United States became less and less secular. In fact, most agree that this move from secularity was due to how BCIs threatened the notion of soul, which the church claimed control over, and which musicians, particularly those of African descent, insisted was their territory. But because this blending of inner with outer worlds left the former susceptible to the manipulation of the latter, primarily by way of hacking and piracy, BCIs would be initially banned from democratic political processes, at least in the West. This changed when it became clear that even a limited merging of mind and AI rendered democracy obsolete. After all, voting was unnecessary given the mining of human consciousness for data and emotional responses by predictive algorithms. As the popular late 21st century slogan had it, choice is unnecessary when need is known. As was the case with sexuality, there would be a series of revolutions in the sphere of creativity. Music is a convenient case study because, as with most media since the birth of sound recording, this would be how many new technologies became domesticated. Now, the creative possibilities of BCIs had been explored far in advance of the Stentrode. Experiments occurred as early as 1965, when iconic experimental composer Alvin Lucier, in collaboration with physicist and amateur organist Edward Dewan, premiered Music for Solo Performer. This piece used brain signals to stimulate musical instruments, famous piece from 1965. This was followed by other experiments in sonifying brain waves or using EEG biofeedback. Richard Teitelbaum, David Rosenblum, for example, were known for that. These experiments became so common that specific BCIs for music, BCMIs, became familiar by the end of the 20th century. They were a way for patients and artists to make music without their motor system. Dewan and Lucier should be given credit for speculating on this very possibility, which is, of course, how most, if not all, music is now made. Because of the BCIs created specifically for musical uses, the problem of the interface or the instrument for artists was resolved. By 2060, music making became untethered from instrumentation, controllers, or even the need for screens. Digital production became virtual, first by way of conventional headsets or goggles, and then ocular implants. By century's end, music left the visual and material world entirely. It could be composed, recorded, and performed by thought and will. BCIs and BCMIs had always depended on filters operating on the frequency spectrum. As signal processing advanced, these filters improved at cleaning neural noise as well as differentiating between types of brain activity. For example, we knew this from the middle of the 21st century, from the middle of the 20th century, synchronous BCIs controlled unconscious or involuntary brain activity, where asynchronous BCIs controlled conscious or voluntary brain activity. This wasn't remarkable, given that the ability to amplify an EQ nerve discharge or neural noise had been possible as early as the 20th century. Filters moved beyond the ability to discriminate between types of brain signals and were able to decode creative choices and intentions with remarkable subtlety. They began to shape neural activity, manifesting even the most baroque aspect of the imagination. For musicians, plugins, virtual studio instruments, and software merged with BCIs and became accessible by thought and will. Payment would, of course, be triggered the same way. By the beginning of the 22nd century, amplification would no longer be necessary once the capacity to produce and consume music neuronally became commonplace. Listeners needed only the will to hear, the ability to pay, and music would resonate in mind as loud and as impactful as the most potent dream, sweetest memory, or stomach-shaking bass terror. Once music went neural, sound was stripped of its materiality. Music became essentially telepathy. Some artists went beyond rhythm, melody, and timbre and generated pure mood, direct emotion, unfiltered nostalgia, passion, lust, regret. Others worked explicitly with time and space, but as authentic experiences, not digitized simulations. Some evolved to work with memory and dream. However, the pre-enhancement minds of the 21st century feared the corporate ownership and control of feelings and sentiments previously thought exclusive to humans. Fear grew once it became clear that such ownership and control had been the trade-off between humans, technology, and Western capital since the 19th century. People became alarmed over losing what they had already lost or that generations never had. They still naively valued privacy and maintained prejudices that came from outmoded notions of a distinct self or atavistic notions of identity. And so, in response to these changes, the move towards state-mandated religion began, and we faced the new dominance of the soul. Yet this new dominance of the soul could not escape old notions of soul. These old notions of soul remained connected to identity, which would always lead back to race, especially music. Once BCIs linked people to AI, and thus to each other, culture became primarily virtual. Identities became more fluid, but less distinguishable. By the end of the 21st century, most human beings had direct access to the same information. Cultural ownership and distinctions dissolved into shared data sets. Other than China and its satellite nations like North Korea and what had been Eastern and Southern Russia, AI made a new global culture during environmental degradation. This culture succeeded in something fascism and xenophobia had failed to do. It halted migration. But migration had already slowed significantly due to the difficulties of movement in the wake of that degradation of the environment and to the arming of borders and public space due to America's turn to theocratic capitalism. In this global stillness, cultural, social, racial, and sexual differences became increasingly meaningless to many. Differences remained, especially economic, but material reality had lost the ability to shape people's ideas about who they were and what communities they belonged to. Also, the 21st century struggles for equality, equity, and inclusion had been remarkably successful. They used BCIs to eradicate bias, racism, sexism, xenophobia, and other prejudices. But this eliminated not just the fundamental opposition between human and machine, but the more fundamental one between self and other. Without a threatened self, prejudice could not function. Freedom was freedom from self. By the end of the 21st century, Black music, as the primary engine of much of the world's music, as well as racial knowledge for three centuries, had essentially ended. It had been assimilated, its sounds, references, and textures no longer products of specific experiences. Despite the persistence of inequality and cultural and racial hierarchies, any response to the environment rooted in specific experiences was no longer impactful, given to how virtual culture had become. Yet at the start of the 22nd century, Black music began to reappear. Much like the late 19th century, early 20th century birth of sound recording, where images of Blacks appeared on gramophones, phonographs, and sheet music, Black people became again the face of a new technology. But this music wasn't created by Black people, or not exclusively. Nor was it about racial or cultural experiences, since experience no longer shaped knowledge or culture. This music was about what Blackness used to mean. Emerging from the collective longings of what used to be called a community and endless stereotypes of racial differences, this new Black music generated a notion of soul distinct from that which was claimed by the church and the governments that serviced it. Black music returned in the beginning of the 22nd century because it was the last thing left to remind white people of what it was like to have had an identity in the first place. Thank you.
Okay, wow. Thank you so much for this talk. We have about 15 minutes time for questions. I'm already gonna open the floor, so to say, and invite the audience in to what I think was actually really mind-blowing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I was asking myself where I am right now. Am I even in the past, in the present? Am I part of the future? Am I a past future? Is somebody actually listening to my inside at the moment? I don't know how you are feeling, but I kind of like felt detected in a certain way. Not that I want to be pessimistic about this, but is it a pessimistic approach?
Good question. I don't take a pessimistic or a utopian approach. I take a matter-of-fact approach, meaning this already is happening. And so I feel like I could just be a reporter from the future saying that this is already happening. All these technologies I've described are already here. They're happening already, right? And so, is it pessimistic? Is it utopian? I guess it depends on who you are and how you read it. But for me, just reporting the fact that this is the world we're in already now.
Which actually leads me to my next question also, because you did mention it, where the line between fact and fiction actually is, or is there one? Is it being connected or disconnected, whichever way we want to see it, through technology?
As I said, I mentioned briefly that the 21st century, I mean the 20th century too, but the 21st century is really when we start to see the line between fact and fiction blur a lot. But the truth is that it only seems blurred because the only way we understand these new technologies is through science fiction, right? But people in the engineering world get a little frustrated because we start to read them through the lens of science fiction when in fact they're not science fiction at all. They're actually quite factual, right? So in this way, science fiction can get in the way of us actually seeing that the reality, social reality, is way beyond science fiction.
As a sociologist, I like to hear that. I don't know about you, because our science isn't really taken very seriously, so-called soft sciences, but that brings a whole new dimension to it. I'm still going to invite you to be part of this conversation. As they say, break the silence. We're already listening anyway. Here we go. Here's somebody at the back.
Thank you very much for pointing out these interesting links in between military technology, synthesizer technology, and compositional advances like the ones Alvin Lucier promoted. I was wondering of, because of you were spotting so much the North American or the Western range of developments, whether you have an idea of what happened in the Soviet Union or now in Russia has a parallel or a different development. I'm thinking of Leon Theremin.
Yeah, of course,
the KGB was incredibly interested in these things and didn't take it just as composers fooling around, but as a possibility to change the world. So what is your idea? Do you think that a parallel movement or a different movement happened in the East?
This is the funny thing about doing a talk written 100 years from now. You're asking for me to tell you what happened when none of this has happened yet. As you see, when I mentioned the Soviet, I mentioned China briefly and the former Soviet Union, right? This is North American because this is the first iteration of a larger project. And it begins with the United States context because that's the one I'm rooted in, right? But I do plan to expand to different parts of the world, Africa, what used to be the Soviet Union, at least what I argue in terms of China and its relationship to the Soviet Union. There are parallels and there are differences. But one thing I do here is I do want to identify that this is about what's happening in the United States. Other aspects of this project will pursue parallel and different developments of different technologies and different histories. So I can't give you a more specific answer than that, other than, yes, I do plan to do that for the larger project. What it will be yet, I can't say. But it will be different, right? Because I'm really interested in what happens in Africa, right, with piracy and the use of technology in completely different cultural frameworks, which is a very important part of my work. But I will pursue that. But right now, this is the first chapter.
If I may piggyback off that question for a minute, how important will national division even be?
Yes, indeed.
In the future,
exactly.
In the digital, in the virtual world,
there will be a constant tension between the borderlessness of the digital and, as I said, the theocratic capitalism, the church, and the move away from secularity as a response to the digital. I see that happening all over the world. So. In the world of the virtual, we like to think that borders are becoming fluid and et cetera. That is happening in the world of the virtual, but I think that there's a backlash in the world of the actual where borders get hardened. I believe that.
Okay, there was a question here. Just a minute, I'll come to you in a minute. She was first.
Thank you so much. It was really inspiring, but I'm so sorry. I'm not sure if I can get my answer right because it's not my first language. And I'm not sure if I understood everything properly. So.
And I'm grateful for you because, you know, I'm in a country where I'm not speaking your language. So I thank you for your patience.
No, thank you very much. So what I really found very interesting were your notions on identity.
Yeah.
But about the end, I'm not sure if I got you right. Now, my question is multi-layered because I tried to understand what you said through references. One is, I come from a family of refugees, mm-hmm. and when I was born here. When I look at my relatives who weren't born here, some of them say, sometimes I feel like I have no identity, but being a refugee,
yeah,
I don't have that problem. I have another problem. And then they say, like, I see these German dads playing with their kids. My dad never played with me in my culture, mm-hmm. and I never had the time to play with my child. In this kind of level of, I don't know, I don't have an identity
yeah.
apart from the problems that I am.
Yes, yes.
Because of being a refugee, right? Yeah. So this was one reference that I tried to keep in mind. The other one was, the author Mishima Yukio from Japan, the famous one.
Yes,
he once said then, after World War II, when he saw the developments in Japan, he said about the Japanese people, in 50 years from now, Japanese people will visit their own culture as tourists.
Yes.
Now, I'm not sure if you were referring to the black identity as, like, because I understood your ending as black people. I guess you mean African-American black people revisiting their own history, but in a nostalgic way, as a placeholder for the white part of society that has lost track of its own identity and building identity way before everything that you explained has happened, like in the past to now. Now, I'm not sure. Yeah, this is where my confusion started.
I'm enjoying your confusion. I think it's wonderful.
Sure, what is your definition of identity, and who are you referring to when you say black people, and what is the nostalgia about?
Well, I'll tell you a bunch of things that'll be just as confusing as your question. As a way of interacting with you as a peer, as a friend on the same level. Well, you know, I'm not African American, so I actually come from a refugee background too, West African refugee. So for me, blackness, when I say black music, in that moment, it's kind of super general, right? I don't want to specify, because the point I'm trying to make at the last sentence is that a lot of this is about how whites will then turn to blackness as the way to remember an identity that they no longer have, or what it was like to have an identity. So when I think about blackness or black music, I have a much more global sense of it than a lot of my peers. So that hopefully answers some of what you're saying. And at the end, I am interested here in that last sentence in white people's relationship to this thing called black music. Because truth be told, black people only call it black music when white people are around. Right? For us, it's just something called music. Right? So that's why that's kind of layers of mediation, I could say, in that last part. So, you know, I respect the confusion, because it is confusing in that regard. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this fascinating story. I was curious about how do you see the future of language and textual-based media in your version of the future? Are they ceased to exist? Are they becoming more underground and are replaced with other forms of kind of interfacing and connecting? As far as I understood, you've mentioned that it would be happening through emotion. Could you please talk a little bit more of where languages are going?
Okay, that's actually interesting, and it connects to your comment too. I mean, Mishima's idea of the Japanese revisiting their own culture, etc. I believe we will all do that, even black people, right? We will all do that once culture becomes extremely virtual and shared data sets and everyone's linked in that way, right? So we're all going to encounter our culture and each other as tourists in a strange sense, right? But your question about what's the future of language, etc. The goal of people who are trying to create the technology, right, that we're talking about, those who are much more optimistic think that it'll be good if we all share the same language, or rather, if we all share the same data sets. So there's a drive towards this kind of unity that gets rid of distinctions. Does that make sense? Right? And so eventually, the colonization of culture and language from those who created the technology becomes a very important political structure or effect. But I'm also interested in how people take a language and take technology and do different things with them. I didn't talk about it in this piece, but to answer your comment, I do believe that what will happen in response to this kind of dominance, right, is going to be a world of piracy and bootlegging and completely redefining technology. I don't know what I think about the relationship between underground and mainstream. I believe those oppositions are already dead. I don't know that I buy them as real oppositions. However, there's going to be always what I call creolizations of technology by different people, et cetera, right? So the perspective you have here in this piece is a perspective of a historian from the future who sees this thing kind of organizing itself in a kind of dominant way, right? Truth is, I don't believe that. I believe that there's other perspectives that are going to be necessary emerging from what you might call an underground, but what I would just call just a Creole space where people do different things with the technology. Does that answer? Yeah, thank you.
We have only a few more minutes. I'm going to push in one question before I go over there, which leads me to W.E.B. Du Bois' The Souls of Black Folk. Mm-hmm. This is what I saw coming alive in your talk. Can you relate or...
I will relate through...
To that?
I don't think you... How about, you know, some of you might know the work of Kojo Ishin. Yeah, Kojo has this wonderful idea in his wonderful book that we should all have read, More Brilliant Than the Sun, where he says that Norbert Wiener, who wrote this book called The Human Use of Human Beings, The Beginning of Cybernetics, Kojo says that that book about cybernetics and machine interface is actually the W.E.B. Du Bois book for the 21st century. That the question of double consciousness and blending with otherness and relationship to race will be the conversations we have about our relationship with machines and technology and otherness. So if you hear that, it's because it's definitely behind my thinking on our relationship to machines as being basically an upgrade or uploading of our relationship to race. Absolutely. My work is rooted in the assumption that how we treat machines in the future will be informed by how we treat others in the past. Absolutely. So I'm glad you see that.
Hi, Louise. Steph here.
Hey, Steph.
Hey. I was terribly late. I only caught the tail end, but still I have questions. And I absolutely agree with, I think whites are already turning to blackness as a way to, I mean, I for one, and my current style goal is to dress like a Jamaican man, and I'm really enjoying that.
I'm sure Jamaican men don't. Which is why I commend you.
Let's not homogenize. I enjoyed what you were saying about music going neural, being completely stripped of its sonic properties. And I was wondering what happens when the, I hope I get the terminology right, when the BCIs and the BCMIs command the sounds that are going on in our brains or in our sensations. What happens to serendipity and chance and to mismatches of emotions and sounds? Are they completely, have they been erased? Is there now a complete match all the time, or what happens?
By the way, please understand, all of the questions that you're asking me are basically saying, Lewis, what's the next chapter? And I'm grateful for that because I haven't written the thing yet. I only wrote this one. But I talked about the BCI and the BCMIs, the asynchronous and the synchronous BCIs. I didn't make that up. They've been able to do that since the middle of the 20th century. Right? Because in order to control brainwaves and to read neural activity, you have to understand that there are voluntary brain signals and involuntary brain signals. So BCIs for a long time have been able to segregate the different types of brain activity because they happen all at the same time. Right? But for me, and this is wonderful because I think that because there are involuntary as well as voluntary, the fact of the involuntary means that serendipity does not go away. It can't go away. It's a part of the irrationality of the brain. I think the problem with a lot of folks who are programmers or working with BCIs, they think they can tame the brain. That's absurd. They can't tame the brain. The irrational is going to always, and the contradictory, serendipity, chaos, that's just endemic to it. And that's going to always be there. Right. But your point, too, about how whites look to black culture, et cetera, I'm hoping that last sentence sounds familiar because there's nothing new about that. It's the history of black music in the Western world. So that's the cycle. Absolutely. Thank you.
Unfortunately, we have one last question until we move on. And this was over here.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming here and speaking. My question was more along the lines, actually, of the last question. But if you could just speak a little bit more about, like, what like bio music looks like today and what it possibly could look like in the future. Because I know you mentioned, like, EEG biofeedback.
That's music. Where it started, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And just, like, devices or systems in which
What it looks like today, and I hope there's no one in the audience who I'm going to offend with this, it's only called music in quotes. It's not really music. I mean, not to, in terms of melody and timbre, the ability to control biofeedback as well as neural activity enough to make it sound or shape it in the way that we understand conventional music, we're not even capable of that yet. But we're clearly going to get there. What I'm suggesting is that it'll move away from this kind of random, aleatoric, experimental noises and sounds to prove a point. With the Stentrode, which is a real thing, with the Stentrode and all of these Neuralink interfaces, we're going to start seeing the actual ability to shape actual, recognizably musical sounds rather than just playing with the rhythms and the random sounds that come out of EEG and biofeedback. Again, but I don't want to insult anyone, but the stuff that's called biofeedback or EEG music, right, it's music. It's really there to make a point. It's not at the point where we can actually create something that we understand and recognize as music, which is why it comes out of the experimental music world, where the relationship between the sound and music is already problematized, right? Does that answer? Thank you, man.
Lewis, thank you so much.
Unfortunately,
our time has run out. This is your round of applause. No hesitation, audience, please.
Thank you
so much. How inspiring. What a fantastic way to kick off this event.